Roughly 13,000 refugees from Iraq and Afghanistan have come to the United States on special visas since 2008. Many of them had provided critical assistance to the United States in their home countries by working as translators, drivers, and political fixers. Those were dangerous jobs, which came with the constant threat of violence from insurgents, but even if you've worked alongside high-ranking U.S. officials, been in firefights with the Taliban, and have been vetted by the CIA many times, coming to the United States is not easy. And once you get here, you can face incredible obstacles. Men's Journal contributing editor Paul Solotaroff has investigated that difficult route, and we have a link to both of his articles on it for Men's Journal on our show page at WMIC.org. I'm very pleased to welcome him back to our show. Hello, Paul.
Leonard, always a pleasure.
An article you wrote in April focused on the experience of, I guess it's Janice Shinwari. An Afghan interpreter. How closely did he work with the United States?
About as closely as you can without drawing a military pension from the DOD. Janice was, in addition to being a brilliant linguist, self-taught, and an incredibly striking sort of heroic figure, was also by far the best marksman on whatever base he was on. He was taught by special forces, and Janice personally shot dead at least five Taliban.
And he was he became close to a first lieutenant named Matt Zeller, and they were in a firefight together.
Well, they were in a number of firefights together. They met, crucially, in a firefight when Janice saved now Captain Matt Zeller from certain death by killing the two Taliban insurgents who had stolen up behind him during a firefight.
Doesn't the Taliban try to avenge those kinds of things?
With every means at their disposal. So,
what did it mean for him and his family?
Well, Janice was so crucial that he wound up living on a U.S. base, which isn't uncommon. A lot of these guys, particularly if they're near a major urban area, will move onto a base, Leatherneck, Dwyer, and they will stash their families, because when word gets out amongst their villagers that a family member is working with coalition forces, it's instant death sentence for not just the soldier, not just the interpreter, but his family as well.
In fact, we've spoken in the past to a number of people who were kidnapped by the Taliban with their interpreters or their fixers, and they were let go, but the interpreters were killed.
Right. So a frequent occurrence for Captain Zeller was going out to the perimeter of his base and seeing a little bag or a box laid at the foot of the gate there. They'd open up the box or bag, and there would be severed limbs belonging to one of their interpreters, with a warning that those who did not repent and quit would end up similarly.
In response, didn't Congress create the Special Immigrant Visa Program in 2008?
It did. It did. And that
so
was
why is that a problem today?
So Congress was well-intentioned, at least in 2008. It forgot to tell our State Department. So the State Department
was— We're talking about two different administrations. It doesn't matter.
We are indeed, that rarely speak to one another except at congressional hearings and under compulsory circumstances. So we had at the time an ambassador, Carl Eikenberry, who was openly critical of the initiative to bring these guys home with us, because his rationale, by his rationale, only 28% of the Afghan population is literate. We couldn't afford to let these people migrate to the United States. They were too important strategically to our efforts there. So,
But they're in danger of being killed if they remain. They're going to be lost to Afghanistan as well.
Well, but if you're diplomatic corps and you have very little experience outside the wire in Kabul, you've no conception of how dangerous life is for these guys.
Who was eligible? The people who had done this translating, done the translating and done the fixing?
So the
but not people who worked with journalists.
No. So civilian aides were exempt from the special immigrant visa provision. So you asked who is eligible. Anyone who served under fire for a year with U.S. military and, importantly, who could demonstrate that their lives were under immediate threat. Well, these are guys whose family members had been kidnapped and assassinated, whose families had been blown up by dump truck bombs, who were constantly being blackmailed, who were being targeted wherever they fled.
Now, why did they decide to take these risky jobs?
Complicated reasons, but I think by and large, well, there are two prime reasons. One, these are the guys who believed in a post-insurgency Afghanistan. They believed that some enduring structure would remain after the fighting ceased, in which at least the major cities would be governable, would be more progressively run, would essentially join the 21st century. And in fact, they have not. Another story. But secondly, they were the best-paying jobs you could possibly hope to find.
My guest is Men's Journal contributing editor Paul Solotaroff. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Do you think that the program undercounted the true number of people on the insurgent and Taliban death lists?
Enormously so. So you had to bring some sort of physical documentation of the fact that someone made an attempt on your life or that someone had marked you for death. Typically, that's not a problem. These guys are getting death notes under their doorsteps every day.
And I'd imagine it's worse now that the U.S. military is no longer as present as it was.
Precisely. So at least Kabul and Kandahar were relatively safe, were relatively free of terrorist events. That's no longer the case.
You write, I'm quoting, in each of our foreign conflicts over the past half century, America has staged withdrawals of its troops, tanks, and spies from bases of operation overseas, but disastrously failed to plan for the dangers its abandoned allies would face after we left. Why do we have such a poor track record in this? And we must have learned something from what happened in Vietnam.
We have learned nothing. We have learned absolutely nothing to our great shame and moral standing in the world. So in Vietnam, we left hundreds and hundreds of thousands of what were then called friendlies, you know, collaborators, civilian workers, and about a million or more were rounded up and put into work camps where at least a quarter of a million of them died under most grotesque conditions. Hundreds of thousands more died at sea in the boat people crisis. And in the wake of that, the shameful wake of that, Congress enacted the Special Immigrant Visa Initiative to bring essentially the children of American GIs home from Southeast Asia.
The visa application process has been described as Kafkaesque. How many layers of bureaucracy and background checks does a typical Iraqi or Afghan have to go through before they can be given asylum?
Nobody really knows, because once the application actually makes its way from the embassy, either in Baghdad or Kabul, it then enters the black hole of Foggy Bottom, and nobody knows where it goes.
They need to have friends. In the case of Janice Shinwari, his friend Max Zeller had to collect 50 letters of recommendations, make dozens of appeals to members of Congress and State Department officials. And even then, how long did it take to get Shinwari and his family into the United States?
Close to 3 years. And so now we're getting a little closer to the present moment. What has happened as a result of guys like Janice and Matt Zeller taking their stories public is that an enormous kind of net of shame has been cast around the State Department. And in recent months, things have changed significantly. The culture is very different now at State than it was just a couple of years ago.
During his background check, Shinwari said he was repeatedly called a terrorist by U.S. officials, mm-hmm. despite what he had done?
Despite what he had done, and based only upon a fraudulent phone call placed to a hotline by the Taliban, who had seen news coverage of Janus and were aware of his efforts to emigrate to the U.S.
So news coverage can cut both ways.
Very, very deeply. And Matt, his sponsor, felt horribly guilty because Janus actually got a visa. And then days before getting on a plane, it was pulled by our embassy in Kabul based upon this one fallacious phone call.
You say that applicants who served with honor for years were treated like terrorists by consul hacks who rarely left the embassy grounds. So they didn't know what these guys had gone through.
No,
I'm assuming it's all men, but there must be some women who also have been put in danger.
The guys who do this work, or the folks who do this work, are almost uniformly men. It's almost impossible for an Afghan woman to get work in any kind of official capacity. And there are reasons for that, largely that women are essentially illiterate in Afghanistan.
Is part of the problem that no one at the State Department wants to be the one who let in an Afghan or Iraqi who turns out to be a terrorist? And how much is Islamophobia playing a part in all of this?
Let's see, somewhere just south of 1,000%. I have talked to State Department officials. I know other journalists who've spoken at length to their contacts. And it's all about this kind of terror of letting the brown wave in.
You quote one American, Adrian Kinsella, who's been trying to get his translator into the United States, as saying, at this point, I'd be better off marrying the guy or smuggling him into Cuba.
Yeah, well, and Adrian, a brilliant young lawyer now who was a Marine captain, actually still is active, is speaking not really facetiously. I think he considered doing those things.
You said that things have changed a little bit. Is this because the Obama administration's policies are changing, because the State Department is changing, or because of awareness of what's going on right now, for example, the success of ISIS in Iraq?
Neither nor. This is about the horrific press that State Department—
So they're just embarrassed.
They're grossly embarrassed and righteously so. So, as I'm about to say, there has been a wholesale granting of visas within the last 6-8 months. There has been essentially a cleansing of whatever stockpile, a purging of the stockpile the State Department had for visas in Afghanistan.
Given the current wrangling over immigration in Congress, is it likely that the special visa program will be expanded or extended?
I think it's more like expendable at this point, at least in the eyes of Congress. If the extension is not granted September 30th, the end of this fiscal year, that slams the door forever.
And do you know how many people might be left behind?
At least 6,000 in Afghanistan whose applications are on file. What we don't know is how many tens of thousands more lack the money to actually formally apply.
This is actually a two-part story. Some of these people do come here, and then they face other kinds of problems.
Yeah.
They're they're dropped into the United States and then abandoned?
That's right. So we all know that the life of a political exile is hard, and then it gets harder. That's simply the unfair story of the kind of strife they encounter. In this case, our political refugees are essentially war heroes, to whom we have made an explicit promise. We will take you home with us. We will set you up. We will grant you the honorary status of Americans who have served faithfully. And in fact, it's been exactly the opposite when they get here.
There are activist groups who work on behalf of them, but one of the Afghan refugees you write about, Fakiri, is working at a Domino's Pizza. That's the best job he could get?
Not only the best job he could get, that makes him the rock star of his cohort. He's got a job. He is earning, $250, $300 a week. That, sort of makes him the one-eyed king.
Why aren't more of them being hired? I'm sure that there is some need for people who know how to speak Arabic and who have a lot of knowledge about Afghanistan and Iraq. Wouldn't they be able to be hired by the government to help in working out policy?
I think that was either the implicit or explicit promise to them that there would be really high-paying and valuable jobs when they got here. The problem is it's now 2014. We've got about 8,000 boots on the ground. There's no need for their services anymore.
And then these people are not receiving training or education to help them make the adjustment to living in the United States?
They are receiving 3 months of rent subsidy. They're receiving 8 months of food stamps. They're receiving 8 months of Medicaid. To the best of my knowledge, that is it. And it's important to spell out who they are. So these are the hardest working, most industrious immigrants we'll ever see. But Afghanistan is not even Iraq. Afghanistan has no infrastructure. There is no power grid. There is no central banking system. There is nothing. They all grew up without indoor plumbing.
So Afghans are having a rougher time adjusting to the United States than the Iraqis?
Far more so, particularly those families who grew up in villages and sent their one son, their one semi-educated son, to a city to try and learn a trade, in this case being an interpreter. But that guy, when he gets here with his wife and two small children, is not only the only English speaker, he's the only one in the household who can read.
And they're becoming embittered. Janice Shinwari told you that in Afghanistan, at least, the graves are free.
Yeah. Again, another joke that isn't the least bit funny and certainly not intended to be. How bad is it here for these families? They are now arriving by the thousands and dumped onto these social relief agencies, Lutheran Catholic Services, et cetera, who seem to be doing the absolute bare minimum and who are horrifically funded by Congress. So such money as there is out there is constantly running out. And the thing we're not doing is helping these guys actually get jobs, helping them connect with services so they can get off the public dole as quickly as possible.
Do they have any advocates in Congress?
They do, but for now, the political will is being expended on getting them here. This is the next big story.
Where did they wind up? Are there certain cities that they're more likely to come to?
Yeah, so the preponderance of these guys have wound up in the greater Washington, D.C. area. There's an enormous kind of influx of immigrant families in interlying Virginia, Maryland, and D.C. itself.
But that's because there's already a large Afghan population in those
areas. I don't know that there was a standing population. There are Afghan communities in the country, in Sacramento, Northern California, and they're going there as well. But again, the difficulty here is that they do need some real hand-to-hand steering for the first 3-6 months. And for now, that is being provided entirely by one man, Matt Zeller, and his nonprofit organization.
You said also that when they are allowed to leave, sometimes it's under the worst of circumstances. One man had 72 hours to leave Afghanistan. That means settling everything.
Sure.
Can they bring their families? They're obviously leaving some family members behind, whether it's uncles or whatever. I would imagine that those people are also in danger.
Terrible danger. And the way that the Afghan provision is written, you can only bring immediate family, wife and children. You can't bring your mother, can't bring your brothers. And those folks are left behind to face terrible, terrible physical harm, whereas the Iraq refugees were allowed to bring extended family.
Is there any hope for the future of these men and their families?
Well, there is hope insofar as these are incredibly industrious and resourceful folks once they get their bearings. You know, we expect the beginnings of the immigrant story to be rough. No one expects it to be this rough. So as I say, there is this one fledgling organization, nooneleft.org, that is raising money and actually paying rent for these people past 3 months, getting furniture for them, getting their children into daycare. That's it.
Paul Solitaris' articles are The Interpreters We Left Behind and Afghan Interpreters Struggle to Find a Home in the United States. They were published in Men's Journal, and we have links to both of them on our show page at WNYC.org. Paul, thank you so much for being on our show again.
Leonard, thank you for letting me tell the stories of these folks.